Hello, this is Jennifer Hill, and the show is Finding Common Ground. I'm Jennifer Hill, and I'd like to welcome you to WBFY, Belfast Community Radio's weekly talk show, Finding Common Ground, and our guest, Jan Anderson, author of The Eagle Flies at Night, a novel set in Portland, Maine, about the immigrant experience and how it is relatable to that of others who've lived here all their lives. Welcome to the show, Jan.
Thank you.
Oh, I should give a station announcement. Belfast Community Radio, WBFY, 100.9 FM in Belfast, Maine, streaming live at belfastcommunityradio.org. And this is a call-in program. Our phone number is 338-2277, and our area code for people listening online is area code 207. So here we are, Jan, here to talk about your new book.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, pretty exciting. Now, you're from California originally, is that right?
No, I'm from
Washington. Well, I got that wrong right off the get-go.
I'm from Washington originally, Washington State, but that I left there when I was 17 years old. So
now, did you grow up in a rural area?
Yes, farming community, desert. The desert part of Washington State.
There's desert up there?
Oh, yeah. There's a big desert. The Columbia River Plateau, which plays a part in my book, actually.
Oh, really?
In the book, one of the characters.
That's right.
One of the characters lived in that particular area. Now, all of the characters in the book actually represent some element of people that I know or places that I'm familiar with.
Yes. I'm looking forward to getting into that. As far as your own growing up, I know you're a gardener now. Are you a farmer? Do you consider yourself a farmer? I know you have a large garden.
What is your question? Am I a farmer?
Did you grow up? Yeah. Are you a farmer? Did you grow up farming yourself?
Oh, no. I grew up where every rural person had a garden.
A garden, yeah.
You know, as we do here in Maine. But no, I lived in a farming community, a rural agricultural area that was
kind of like Belfast?
Yeah, it was irrigated by the Columbia River. But other than that, it's like Belfast, about the same size as Belfast, actually.
Was it close to, is it in the northern section or the
right in the very eastern? Center.
Oh, right in the center.
Right in the very center.
Wow. So did you go to Seattle for your big?
Oh, easy.
Yeah. Wow.
But that's way
long ago.
I left there when I was 17. When you grow up, you're not only your childhood events, but the geography in which you grew up.
Definitely.
Is just an indelible part of your experience. And actually, all of our experience lives in our memory, our imagination, our unconscious. And that's the well from which we draw any inspiration that we're going to include in writing.
That's why I wanted to ask you about it. So what brought you to Belfast? How did you arrive here?
Oh, well, work, actually. Traveled here for work, and I love the coastal area and met people that I became attached to and didn't want to leave.
And you you graduated from college with a degree in ministry.
Well, not exactly. Oh. Just religion. But that was, I was pretty young at that time. I was in a place where I was searching for something.
Yeah.
And it appealed to me at the time. After I exhausted that potential, I went on to Syracuse University and studied psychology and education again. I thought education would be my career choice. And after I did that for a while, I went on to the University of Maine at Orono and pursued another graduate degree in counseling psychology, utilizing writing as a therapeutic voice.
Interesting backdrop for that, for your story. So you have been a community organizer here in Belfast for years, starting up the Women's Space on Main Street. I remember that very well. And the Feminist Times, and most recently, the local food storage facility in Belfast. What made you decide to write a novel?
Well, I've, as I said just a moment ago, I've been a writer all of my life. Writing is a way of exploring the unconscious, the imagination, our memory, and putting in putting all of those factors into a coherent form. Fiction never felt like my voice. For many years, I've written lots of other things, a lot of poetry and unpublished poetry, lots of letters, lots of editorials, things like that.
Sermons, I've heard
sermons.
I've done sermons
at my church. So in those ways, I have been able to capture my experience and my thinking and my reading. And a few years ago, you want me to talk about how the book came about?
Sure, yeah.
Well, a few years ago when I was in a writing group and everyone wanted to write fiction except me, and I said, fiction, huh? Well, I was facilitating the group, so I thought it would be appropriate to do that. And I actually found that it was fun and amusing and exciting. And at the time, that was 3 years ago, the governor was threatening to withhold funding from the city of Portland if they supported the refugee population, which were mostly Somalis at that time, other populations also. And I just found it surprising, shocking, startling that a leader of the state would make that kind of a threat. That was way before Donald Trump. I didn't know even who Donald Trump was. And
wow.
I didn't know who Donald Trump was until Inauguration Day because he was just a fantasy to me. But anyway,
Now you know him all too intimately, as we all do.
At that time, I thought, well, if I were part of a community in Portland, similar to the community I'm in here in Belfast, what might I do as a community activist, as a member of a religious or spiritual community? What might I do? And that was sort of how I took it off. Each of the characters just took a different way of approaching this question of what do we do with this kind of response from our government leaders and leaders in a community like Portland, and also the refugees and how they adjust to a new home. How do they deal with their trauma of their past? How do they deal with the potential for violence in their future, in their current situation? You don't just walk away from trauma. You don't walk away from the threat of violence just because you've left your country. It lives in you all of your life. And so I wanted to explore all of that potential in the book. Now, some of the characters in the book have names from people in Belfast. I've had a few people in Belfast read it, and they recognize the names, of course. And then I have had people say, hey, you used my name in your book. Well, I did use a few people's names, but I don't pretend to know who those people really are as people. It's just a name that appealed to me. I didn't want to make up names, so that's how the names came about.
I love that. I love in reading it that these places and names appear that I recognize colors. So there are lots of characters in the book. Which was your favorite?
My favorite. Whew. You know, I'm in love with all of them. They all just have this spark of humanity in them that drew me to their consciousness. They all live in me, of course, but I try to also to use my imagination and my knowledge of people in general. I don't think I have a favorite, but there are certain voices that, like Buck.
That's what came to my mind.
His voice is just like, yeah, he's right there. And the voice of the and I don't know any Episcopalian. I know the local Christopher, his Episcopalian priest, but I don't know any other. And I actually thought I would model him after the BBC mystery series where there's a vicar in every one of those murders. And I thought, well, a vicar would be a good character to put in here. And then, of course, I had to drop the word vicar because in the United States they're called priests.
Right.
So after I had written the first draft, I had to change all of the word vicar to priest. And
that's pretty easy nowadays. You just search and replace.
I also had these sort of neutral names for characters. And then towards the end, I said, okay, the name of this person really. And that was the case with the priest, who was Thomas. Thomas I really liked, but I had to change the last name because Johnson is more Swedish or something, Danish, Swedish. And I wanted an English person. So I changed it to Giles.
Interesting. So was it fun to write? You say it was fun. I just wanted to ask a little process question about.
Yeah.
People, writers talk about torture. But
it was fun. It was challenging. It was exciting. I wasn't writing it to publish. I didn't imagine an audience. I just always said to myself every time I sat down to write, and I thought about it constantly. The writing itself, the mechanics, was not a lot of time. It took me a year to do the first draft, but a lot of internal processing, listening to the voice of the characters, imagining the situation in Portland. And so it was all of those things. It was fun, challenging, exciting, and hard work. Hard work.
What was the hard part? The writing, the actual writing maybe? Or
editing. The writing itself was not hard. Editing. But once you have the first draft, which took a year, then you start thinking, okay, does this part of what I've written in the first draft really contribute to the story, or can I toss it out? And maybe there's another part that I might want to improve on or add to, or a scene that needs to have a little more information in it. I should say this right off. One of my complaints after a whole lifetime of reading books is there are too many words. So always I was thinking,
The shorter books.
I don't want a lot of unnecessary words.
Is it the description that's becomes
sometimes onerous? Sometimes I think that the writer is just meandering, and it's like you could read a whole page and say, you know, it's just like my head starts spinning, and I'm like, just get to the story. And my characters do a lot of thinking, and that's part of the story. Mm-hmm. We all do a lot of thinking. We don't just talk all the time. So I have characters that are thinking about their own life and what brought them to this place, where they're now working on behalf of refugees, or where they're escaping a traumatic life in Somalia, or you know, whatever it is that they're dealing with internally. We think about, I put in the book in a shorthand form, of course.
Yeah, I noticed that it was in italic a lot of times what the characters were thinking. I'm here with Jan Anderson, author of The Eagle Flies at Night. And this is Jennifer Hill, and the show is Finding Common Ground. The governor in your novel, the governor of Maine, is a character. Did you draw him pretty much true to life?
Well, I don't. Did I draw him true to life? I could only base that on what I've read that he said. I did describe him in the way that I've seen him. So as much as I know about him, yeah. I did include the fact that he was homeless from 11 years old, and so where's his empathy? I describe him physically and his voice as a gravelly, gruff voice.
Yeah, there's a little bit of fact in with the fiction. There's a tense quality in the characters' lives. Though good things happen, they don't seem like lighthearted people. Is this how you experience life?
I'm afraid it is. Much to my dismay. I know that people might find that surprising, but I think deeply about things, and they do affect me much more than I would like them to.
It seemed like even when good things were happening, that kind of tension was there with the characters and what they were thinking and feeling.
Mm-hmm.
That does seem true to life to me. I mean, the sunny days you feel a little guilty for being down. I mean, you're supposed to be all happy. But I
never feel guilty for being down. It's the only place I know. Sometimes when I'm not downhearted, I'm thinking, what's going on that I'm not paying attention to.
That's good.
Unfortunately, I don't want to overemphasize that because there certainly are upbeat experiences in life.
Yeah.
But I have sought out a more spiritual direction in life in my later years after beginning that in that place, then moving into psychology and then moving into philosophy. And all of those things are part of the intangible aspects of living. My knowledge of the physical is good, but it's not nearly as great as my capture of the metaphysical or the intangible aspects of life. There's just so much that goes on inside of us that we cannot see. And for me, a lot of my life has been about uncovering those things, those deep things that motivate humanity, that motivate us. Myself, first of all, of course, because that's the only person I can really know. But also making it possible for other people to explore their own deepest secrets and their own, not to reveal them to everyone, but just to know them. If we know, truly know ourselves, we are in more of a place of contentment and can contribute more to life.
One of the sort of themes running through the book is this crossroads. Crossroads,
oh, right.
It comes up a lot, where characters are, oh, gee, I'm at this crossroads. This is kind of a thematic element in the novel. Can you talk a little bit about that and where that comes from, maybe in your own experience? Or
yes, it's as human beings, I don't know that other people experience this as much as I do, but I have been at many crossroads in my life where I've said, is this enough? Have I done this particular, especially in the work world? It's like, okay, I've done this. Have I done it enough? Is there some element of life that I could explore now? Is there some other path to take? And quite often I would go down another path. Always there's been a philosophical foundation to what I've done. But I've explored many different ways of living out that philosophical foundation. And sometimes I say to myself, maybe I should have just really committed myself to just one dramatic thing. And but that wasn't me. When I got to a crossroads, I would say, okay, am I finished with that? And now what's the next path?
I'm thinking of a train, crossroads. The train arrives. Am I ready to get off at the station or not? Or do I want to get on a different train and which way to go?
Exactly. Yeah.
So it's kind of a metaphor for all kinds of life decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what made you pick immigrants? It is a topical.
Pardon, would you say that again?
Yes. What made you decide to write this book about immigrants? I mean, why that? There's a lot going on right now, but what made you center on immigrants?
I think we have an immigrant. We are a country of immigrants, and everybody is saying that now. But I've always been struck by that fact that we are a country of immigrants. And what was the impact of immigration from the very first day with the Native Americans? And so I chose the immigrant population because you can explore everything there.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody came from somewhere. We're all refugees from something. And in fact, some of my characters are refugees from their past life. So I thought that was sort of a metaphor for what we all are dealing with in just making a home for ourselves. Home is also a big part of my book. How do we create a home? How do we welcome other people into the home we've created?
Also tribalism. I picked up on tribalism.
Yes.
From it doesn't matter if you're not from Somalia. You still have a tribe that you still might be sort of wrestling with how to fit in or get away from.
That's true. Our identity is steeped in... A tribe is steeped in I grew up in the West, where there's less of that there because it was settled much later than the East. So all of us in the West were sort of immigrants from the East.
Well, they sort of annihilated all the Indians out there.
Yes, that too. But I forgot what I was.
Sorry.
The tribe.
That's a crass comment.
So there are elements of tribalism, and of the main militia plays a part in the book too. So, and that is sort of
partly why
they're in there. That whole sense of we belong to a tribe. How do we protect our boundaries, our tribalism?
And therein you find the other.
The other. That's right.
So,
and even in a tribe, the other is in the tribe with you sometimes.
Exactly. Yeah.
There's conflict among our tribal members as well as anywhere. So how do we explore the concept of interpersonal tribalism, interpersonal conflict? And how do we learn to accept people as they are and forgive people if they aren't perfect, according to our standard of what's perfect?
Mm.
We have lots of expectations of people around us. How do we, and we have expectations of ourselves. How do we really give people a break, including ourselves?
I was thinking, I grew up in cities and always lived in cities before I came to Maine. And there's an element of the small town life that I just can't get used to. And it has to do with the gossip and the backbiting that goes on in small towns. And, you know, they're notorious for it. You always hear that. And it's really true. There's a lot of it. So there you have a kind of a tribe that, In as much as we can get together and point the finger at Susie over there who's not doing it, you know, our way, or sort of scapegoating people, all that has elements of the tribalism, don't you think?
Yes. And, you know, to really be honest.
Yeah, let's be honest.
I grew up in a family with a mother who never gossiped and never tolerated gossip. She might have been the subject of gossip in our small community. I don't know, because I was young. But she never did. And she wouldn't. And that's how I grew up. It's not part of my DNA. I don't know anything about gossip. And I don't hear it, and I don't share it.
Yeah.
It's just.
Actually, my mother didn't like it either.
So I'm sure that if we were honest, none of us really likes it. Because it's always a judgment.
But there's something.
It's always judging. You're judging that person, and they're not perfect.
But it also feels good in some level to be on, we're together in this. We're really close because we agree, and that person is on the outs. And I think that's what feeds it. That's why people do it.
Yeah.
So Thomas, the minister of the Episcopal Church, seems to be the main character of the book. I noticed you dedicated the book to the former minister of the UU Church here in Belfast. Is Thomas drawn from Dean Perkins' character?
Yes, I would say he was. And as I said when I started, I wasn't really writing for an audience. I was writing for myself. And so he was the most familiar minister to me. And I happened to have a great deal of respect for him. So I thought, well, I would use, but it's not 100%, of course.
Of course not. No, it's
because
fiction.
Because Dean never served in the Vietnam War, and my minister character, Thomas, did. But the person of Dean, his character, his empathy for people, his desire to understand people and to contribute to bettering the world. That is all part of.
It's really kind of fun to read the book and get the references to, like, the color teal, which is, we know each other in other contexts, and that color teal came up, and also people's names in different circumstances. Oh, yeah, I recognize that, you know. It's cool.
Well, teal is one. As I got closer to the end, I had another thought that I wanted the chapter titles to reflect a particular transition through the book. I don't know how many people are going to get that, but it meant something to me that the chapter titles moved through the book in a particular way and reflected on part of the underlying message that I wanted people to get. And I'm just going to have to let the reader use their imagination to try and figure out what that was. Because it meant something to me, but it will mean something completely different to a different reader.
That's art.
That's art.
That's art. So the main militia is a featured group in the story, and the wives of the militiamen, some of the wives, all of the wives, actually. I was interested in Kay, which is the minister's wife. These women seem to be drawn as cooks and supporters, and there's a lot of that. Do you really suppose that that's the way the wives of the militiamen are? I mean, I assume they are men. I don't know if there are any militia women, but.
Well, I think Carolyn Shute's in the main militia.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
That is true.
But it seemed to me that, and this is a broad generalization, I know, but it seemed to me that the main militia may represent a certain idea about the roles of people in society. And and many women in our society do serve those roles.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I do too, to a certain degree.
Mm-hmm.
So I just, it doesn't mean that they were subjugation to their husbands. They have their own relationship with the husbands of the main militia, but they were a part of the main militia also. And that's all part of my imagination. I don't know any real people in the main militia.
Okay. The minister's internal reflections provide the story's backbone. This is just a quote from the book. The governor is just the visible face of opposition. Behind him is a mob pressing for their slice of the pie. This is a thought that's going through the minister Thomas's mind at one point. Is he being sympathetic to the poor here? Do you think?
I think he has a great deal of empathy for everyone. And the people who feel imposed on by the refugees are certainly a part of our culture. And his question has more to do with if there is this embodiment of people that, and it's not just poor people that don't like the refugees, wealthy people don't like the refugees because they see that their wealth is being compromised in some way.
Which seems like a stretch to me. I don't really get that, but yeah. I mean, how could their wealth be compromised by refugees that are coming in? But yeah.
Right. But
they get that, I'm sure.
But what I'm trying to say is he's just being reflecting on who the governor is speaking for and what kind of support he's getting for this particular point of view. Again, I started writing this 3 years ago, and so things have changed considerably since then. My book's not nearly as dramatic as the news is today, so
don't
read it for the excitement, because you can get more excitement from the news.
This is Belfast Community Radio, WBF. Y 100.9 in Belfast, Maine, and we're streaming live at BelfastCommunityRadio.org. I'm here with Jan Anderson, author of The Eagle Flies at Night, and the show is Finding Common Ground. Well, in that quote, he says, the governor is just the visible face of opposition. Behind him is a mob pressing for their slice of the pie. What that evokes for me is the Trump situation. I mean, Donald Trump is quite a character. I mean, in anyone's estimation, he's quite a character. We could elect anybody among us. There are lots of characters, but it's in the people behind him that got him elected that you have to ask the question, how did we get here? I don't know. I just thought that was a really...
I'm not sure that we got here. I just think it happens to be what's visible right now. I think that probably there have been people always that had that particular approach to life and approach to other people. And it just, it's just that at this time right now, it's a threat to us, and it's risen to a level of visibility that I never thought was possible. But me there either. It is.
Well, there we have it. Now, Oscar Romero is another real person who appears in the story as a kind of mentor for Thomas. He was a priest in South America.
He was the Archbishop of El Salvador. And he was actually on the side of the oligarch in El Salvador until he became Archbishop, and he realized what the wealthy people were doing to the population of the Indians and in El Salvador.
What, did he grow up in a cocoon somehow? How did he not know it until?
Well, I'm not sure about that. What I know about Archbishop Romero is the 3 years, sort of like Jesus, the 3 years that he was Archbishop, he preached continuously, share the wealth, live your life more like Jesus would. These people are starving. These people are being displaced. He was assassinated after 3 years. And so what I include in the book are really elements from his sermons that were published and that I think Thomas would have read. So that in that way, Archbishop Romero, who was a Catholic priest, became sort of a model or a mentor to Thomas.
And the facet to his personality that I picked up on was his courage.
Courage, yes, the courage, the courage to be able to speak the truth.
That takes a lot of courage.
Yeah, and in our culture today, this fear of that we're going to lose something if we welcome refugees. This is a huge, very wealthy country. We don't have to mistreat people in order to continue our livelihoods. We'll just find another way, you know? It's like these are crossroads. Those people faced a crossroad and came to America, and now we face a crossroad in welcoming them here.
Yeah. The cultural differences arise in a relationship between two lesbian characters, one from the U.S. and the other from Somalia. I don't really get the nature of their relationship in terms of, them being threatened because of their relationship, but it very much affected by Somalia and the imam. Is that how you pronounce it?
Imam.
Imam.
Yeah. Well, lesbianism is not an acceptable lifestyle or character in Islam or in more fundamental Christian circles. So that is part of the conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And I know people who are lesbians, and so I wanted to include that as part of the story because it's a place of conflict.
Mm-hmm.
The book really deals with a lot of different kinds of conflict.
Mm-hmm. Yes. A grieving mother and son are central to the story, so we get really intimate with Jacob, the boy, who's a really sensitive child. And I'm struck by your approach to the boy in terms of telling the story. You don't usually, when you're reading a novel about a teenage boy, he's much more aggressive and testosterone laden or something. But this boy is tender and tentative. And I wonder, do you see role models of that in boys? Do you see that in life? I mean, they certainly aren't depicted that way in literature a lot of times.
Well, that's something I hadn't thought about. I was trying to portray people as I think they really are, not we live in a culture where males and females are given particular behavioral patterns which are acceptable and which are not acceptable. Certainly there are teenage boys that don't fit that model. And since he moved from the far west to Maine as a teenager, I felt that being transported from one culture to another, he would be more reflective on where do I fit in this culture. He is a very talented baseball player, and so that's the way his... but yes, I do think there are plenty of teenage... He's 12 in the book, goes from 12 to 13, so there's changes going on, and he is trying to fit into his environment.
The character is very understated, as Buck is. I think they don't always jump to answer a question or leap into the situation, but frequently it seems like they just let things go by.
One of the people in town that read my book's comment was, "You ask a lot of questions, and you don't give any answers." And I think I didn't have any answers. I couldn't make up an answer for the character to give because I don't think there's any answers to many of these things.
Sometimes people make them up, though, frequently. And
well, I think my way of approaching these things is to be open-minded, to open your hands to people, to welcome people, to learn about people and understand them more. So that's really the kind of community that I thought would exist where I would live.
So is that the way you drew your characters? Did you just open your mind to them and let them tell you what they wanted to say?
That's really, well, if you're getting into the writing process here, I think of writing as an art form. When you start out writing, you're an apprentice. You're learning how to do this. Then you become an artisan, which means you know how to use the tools of writing. You know, the pencil and the paper and the imagination. To really reach the level of an art form, you have to hear the voice from inside of you, not necessarily in your mind, but you have to be able to capture both your unconscious and your imagination and put it all together with all of the tools that you know. So I think I've strayed away from the question.
No, I'm actually fascinated by what you're saying now.
I always try to answer the question, but I lost that thread.
That's okay. I think that's just a really interesting thing about the process itself, which is fascinating to me about writing. Now, Buck is a homeless man who appears periodically in the story. He, like all the characters, suffer, but his suffering seems understated, too. A lot of times he walks away when somebody asks him a question rather than responding.
I'm interested in the fact that you call it understated, and I suppose that's true. I think in a lot of fiction, it's the opposite. Rather than the way people might really behave, they behave in this grandiose and spectacular way in a book, which isn't how it would happen in real life. I guess among all things, I just really wanted to portray people as I thought they might really be when they were in these situations and confronted by these things. I know those other exciting and dramatic and grandiose incidents do happen in real life. But I really just wanted to take ordinary people, put them in an ordinary situation.
I didn't find all of the characters that way, understated. But those two did seem to me to be, I mean...
Buck and Jacob?
Yeah. So, you know, generally in conversation, you respond, you answer when somebody asks you a question but those two, they were
both... That is very true, and I wouldn't call it understated as much as they have an element of their own personality that they want to keep secret. They do not know how much of their person, how much of their experience and their thinking and their feelings would be acceptable in the culture around them. Mm-hmm. And so they have a more secretive element to their character.
Yeah, I would go along with that. The Flying Eagle is a bus line. How did you come up with that title?
Well, I don't want to give away the book.
Really? Because it's on the front cover. There's a bus on the front cover.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was just from my imagination. You know, it was not.
I always wonder about titles.
It just emerged in the process of writing, rewriting. Actually, I didn't know the title until almost the end when it just came to me that from my living with these characters for so long, that's how the title came.
Hmm. Okay. Have you ever met an immigrant? And had a discussion with them about what it's like, or is this just your
imagination? No, I live in this very sheltered community called Belfast, so I have not personally. I grew up with immigrants. I lived in an agricultural community, so we had Mexican immigrants, which I was a child, so they were my friends. I didn't even think of them as immigrants. I learned how to make tortillas and things from the mothers of my and one of my other friends was Japanese. And at that time, probably her parents may have been in an internment. I don't know. It didn't mean anything to me. It was just, you know, I didn't think about that.
The bliss of childhood.
They were just part of the community and part of my classroom. And so they were my friends.
Mm-hmm. So are you looking forward to talking to an immigrant who's read the book and see what they
I'm
think?
I'm very much looking forward to talking to an immigrant. But I'm also looking forward to talking to other people. I just really like to know, it's not a typical book of fiction. I will say that because I know from all I've read thousands of books, fiction and nonfiction, and I couldn't write that kind of a book. I just needed to write a book that emerged from my own heart. And this book did.
And how do you see this as being different from other books?
It's not very dramatic. But it covers.
Really? That wasn't my experience.
It's understated. There is drama. There is tension. There is conflict. But it, how do I say this? It's something that could happen in any community. And sometimes when you read a book, you say, nah, that would never happen. I read books like that. I like them, actually.
Yeah.
I like all kinds of books, but I just felt like I wanted I just wanted something that could be placed right in the city of Portland and could actually happen.
Yeah.
So,
In some ways, it's a very optimistic book about what could happen to immigrants when they come here. So, are you planning to write another book?
Well, I haven't been inspired to do that yet. I'm still working with the publisher on final details. And every time I think it's going to happen, that it's going to be released, something comes up, mostly on my end. And I say, I don't like that. I want to change it.
Oh, so I bet they love you for that.
It's changed. So I started working in January with the publisher, and I thought it would be out in May. And May came and went. June came and went. The uncorrected edition came in July. And I said, there's mistakes in here. Let's fix them, which the copy editor didn't pick up. So I'm right now. The book has gone to the printer. And I thought I would have the final version in my hands at this time. But I don't. So it's at the printer. And as soon as I get it and approve it, then it will be distributed. It will go to the printer for the...
What's the latest expectation on that?
I would say right after Labor Day, which is disappointing to me. I really wanted it out this summer.
Now, is this a self-published book, or is this something that, I don't know, the publishing house, is this like a Covenant Books?
Yeah, it's the... Published by the publisher in South Carolina, yeah.
So it's not a Vanity Publishing or whatever they call it.
I don't know what that is.
That's where you pay to have it published. Yeah. But this is actually...
So I'm thinking that it will be out like right after Labor Day, and And there will be a press release at that time and, you know, whatever. So I would like to hear from people what they think when
are they going to be sold like all over the country? Yeah. Or are they going to start with a region?
All over the country. And, you know, I have family and friends all over the country. So at least a few books will be bought.
Are you going to be traveling around to sign books?
I have no plans for that. I'm going to return to my isolated lifestyle.
Retirement.
Yeah. That part of it is not part that's attractive to me. I'm an introvert, so I prefer writing to talking. And, you know, I like to talk about things and ideas especially, but small talk's not big on my list of fun activities. Yeah. And so in some ways, the characters really resemble me in that they don't do a lot of small talk. Mm. It's thoughtful.
So do you, when you write, when you sit down to write, is there a particular time of the day, or do you use a pencil and a paper, or do you use the computer? How do you?
I use a notebook and a pen. And once I've reached a point of where I think I have something that's working, then I put it on the computer. And so almost on a daily basis, I take it from the notebook to the computer. Sometimes I do drafting on the computer too. It's not all in the notebook, but it's small scenes. A lot of thinking and processing goes into before it actually becomes a physical presence on the page.
Is there any advice you would give somebody who's writing a book, since this is your first experience and you've done it?
Well, the advice I give to every person who wants to write is you really just have to do it, and you have to listen to, there's a voice inside of each of us that represents our own experiences in life, some traumatic and some pretty great. And being able to get in touch with that voice and really listen to our heart. The mind does the work, but the heart produces the art, is how I think of it. And stick to it. My book lived in my mind for all the time. But the writing itself, again, as I said earlier, might have been at 9 o'clock at night when something just, I had to put it down because I'd been thinking about it for hours. And quite often I would sit down at 8 o'clock in the morning and work for 3 hours. So that's, I try to have I have a very structured day actually, but the writing part fits in anywhere. Just whenever I'm inspired or whatever the word is.
I was thinking about writing and that your arm comes out from your heart, not from your head. So connecting up that way.
Yeah. Well,
maybe
yes.
You're left-handed even more so. So how could people reach you to talk about the book? And
I think leaving a message on my home answering machine.
Okay.
The number is 207-338-1429. Or more easily for me is a text for my cell phone, which is 207. I forgot my number. 216-5329. 216-5329. I changed my phone number recently.
Okay.
So
you're forgiven.
It's not very easy to remember. But a text, and then I could get back in touch with people.
Well, thank you so much for being with us, Jan Anderson. The book is The Eagle Flies at Night, and I'm sure it'll be in bookstores around here this fall, possibly, if all goes well.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you. You're welcome.
And next week, I want to let our listeners know that Ray Estabrook will be on the show talking about a historical narrative. And the week after, we're going to have a series starting of local house races, and we're going to be hearing from Nathalie Arruda and April Turner, Paige Ziegler, Scott Cuddy, And then we're going to be hearing from Zach Ringelstein, who's running for U.S. Senate. And after that, John Lieberman, who's running for district attorney. So, lots coming up. The political scene is heating up. Once again, I want to thank you all for listening, and we will talk to you next week.